Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The news that COVID-19 has now claimed 1 million lives is an agonizing milestone, UN Chief Antonio Guterres has said. Marking the toll, the UN Secretary General said that it was a mind-numbing figure, but that the world must never lose sight of each and every individual life. The victims were fathers and mothers, wives and husbands, brothers and sisters, friends and colleagues, he said in a statement, which pointed to the tragedy felt by so many families, unable to say goodbye to their loved ones without holding a hand or extending a gentle kiss. Although there was no end in sight to the pandemic, nor the upheaval it has brought to our lives, Mr. Guterres urged people and nations to act in solidarity to overcome the disease. Warning against the dangers of misinformation, Mr. Guterres insisted that responsible leadership matters, as does science and cooperation in the relentless hunt for a vaccine that must be available and affordable to all. In a related story, the head of the UN Health Agency, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said that despite the massive scale of death and suffering from COVID-19, there are glimmers of hope. 9 months after the virus was first identified, some of the best scientists in the world have worked together to combat it, Tedros said. They have developed tests to diagnose cases, identified treatments including corticosteroids, which reduce mortality, and produced vaccine candidates that are now in final phase 3 trials, the World Health Organization chief insisted. And with further breakthroughs yet to come, the WHO Director General urged people to remember that the virus can be effectively contained with tried and tested public health measures. Highlighting countries that have been successful in containing the coronavirus, Tedros praised their all-of-government, all-of-society response. These included Uruguay, where sustainable investment in public health had created a robust and resilient health system, and Pakistan, where health workers trained in polio surveillance have been redeployed to tackle COVID-19 via contact tracing and care. Finally, torrential rains and flooding across South Sudan have created the threat of catastrophic levels of hunger and left hundreds of thousands homeless, UN humanitarians said on Tuesday. Around 700,000 people are in crisis after floodwaters swept across the country, submerging villages, land and livestock, according to a World Food Programme WFP alert. Matthew Hollingworth, WFP country director in South Sudan, described the flooding as likely the worst in 60 years. He explained that this year's rains had begun before last year's floodwaters had receded fully. He said that homes and clinics have been submerged across Jonglei and Unity State, communities are stranded, and animals now lie dead in the fields.
There is a very significant flood covering vast areas of the country now, more than 36 counties of the country underwater, submerging entire villages, homes, farmsteads, killing livestock, and putting an end to livelihoods, etc.
WFP's Matthew Hollingworth ending that item. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alice Smith.
2020.
Wildfires, strong storms, heat waves, low sea ice, and melting glaciers. Kevin Trenberth and Mike Benton, two scientists at the top of their game, explain how we got here and where this goes. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is a widely known climate scientist. Dr. Kevin Trenberth is a distinguished scholar at NCAR, the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. Kevin was a lead author of the 2001 and 2007 IPCC Scientific Assessment of Climate Change. And now, as American roils in climate denial, disease, and protest, Dr. Trenberth is back in his native New Zealand. Kevin, how do you describe your official position these days?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a distinguished scholar at NCAR. That is a special sort of an emeritus appointment, which gives me full access to all of the library. Basically, what it means is that I continue to do research and activities. I just don't get paid anymore. But it does give me a couple of other privileges, such as an annual trip. I'm supposed to return to NCAR once a year. And the thing which has upset a lot of this, of course, is the COVID-19 pandemic, which has firstly canceled my retirement party and the celebration of this particular appointment, and, of course, limits any travel that subsequently might occur. Now, the other thing which has happened is that since I've moved to Auckland, New Zealand, for my retirement, I am affiliated faculty at the University of Auckland in the physics department here. And so I have some local contacts. Again, things like seminars and meetings have been cut down because of the COVID-19 restrictions.
Looking back into the 1990s, you worked on defining what an El Niño is, just as the world hit a new hot year in the winter of 1997-98. That was the new record for a hot year by a mile, and I remember the Indonesian peat fires. In 2003, you and Thomas Carl worked on a description of modern global climate change. So now in 2020, are you sure we have entered a new state here on Earth?
Well, there's no doubt climate change is with us, and that the climate now is different than it would have been without all of the human influence on climate. So just to refer to that, you know, there's humans do a lot of things in terms of changing land management, farming, all sorts of things. There's a lot of air conditioning and space heating in winter. And so on. But all of that use of energy and electricity turns out to be very small compared with all of the natural flows of energy through the climate system. This is one of the things which I've been spent a lot of time studying. And the main way in which humans interfere with the climate system is by interfering with the natural flows through the system, and that's by changing the greenhouse effect. And so that's in particular the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So carbon dioxide has increased by 40%, 45% since pre-industrial times, and continues to go higher and higher. And of course, all the wildfires that are occurring at the current time don't help that at all either. And so even with the pandemic, although there's been some reports that, you know, with less air travel and so on, that carbon dioxide shouldn't be going up as much, but it is, and it's related in part to things like wildfires. In any case, the human influence on the changes in composition in the atmosphere is what is causing climate change, and it's really there's really no doubt at all whatsoever that that's happening. And, you know, you've only got to look around right now and see in the United States evidence of it with the wildfires all along the West Coast and another tropical storm, Hurricane Sally, and a very active hurricane season out in the Atlantic as a couple of symptoms.
I admit that I have a little bit of a fixation with something ocean warming, and in the first decade of broadcasting this show, I found it really hard to get precise numbers or even solid news about how much the ocean is warming. I noticed last January we got this headline from ScienceAlert.com, quote, "The ocean is warming at a rate of 5 atom bombs per second," scientists warn. That sounds very alarming, Kevin. Is it?
Oh, yes. This is refers usually to the 20 kiloton variety atomic bomb that was used in Japan at the end of World War II. And so, you know, we're not talking the megaton bombs, but even megaton bombs are sort of equivalent in a way to a major thunderstorm. And a hurricane consists of a whole complex and cooperative of thunderstorms. Many, in terms of energy, many atomic bombs going off in a single hurricane, let alone in terms of the global climate system. So I don't particularly like that particular analogy, and I've used different analogies myself relating to, say, how much electricity we generate in the world or how much electricity we generate in the United States and the energy imbalance that is caused by the increase in carbon dioxide is a factor of nearly 100 greater than all of the energy that's generated by electricity around the world. And so it's sort of suggests, as I said, that the human influence directly trying to compete with the sun is not much of a competition, but that this is a really substantial contribution by blocking the outgoing radiation back to space through the increasing greenhouse effect. And on the other hand, you can't go outside and say, oh, I can feel global warming, because that effect is still about a factor of 200 less than the actual sun itself and the flow of energy, the natural flow of energy through the climate system. And so what matters then is the accumulation of that energy. And the thing is, it's always in the same direction. And so it does accumulate. The main place it accumulates is in the oceans. And so the oceans are breaking records year after year. 2019, in terms of calendar years, is the warmest the global oceans have been on record. And the previous record was 2018, and the previous record was 2017. And then there's a little twitch with 2015 being next before 2016. And the reason 2016 is not quite line up is because heat came out of the ocean in 2016 as a part of the major El Nino event that occurred then. And that's why 2016 is actually the warmest year on record in terms of the global mean surface temperature. And so we have to distinguish between, you know, the surface air temperature versus the temperature of the oceans. The oceans are certainly the warmest on record year after year now. But this year through August, global mean surface temperature is the second highest on record, still behind 2016, but there's a lot more variability in the global mean surface temperature than there is in the ocean temperature. So the ocean temperature is actually a very good monitor, and we can do it now reliably, and it's a good monitor that the globe is really warming.
Yeah, I remember reading a few months back that a Chinese scientist suggested we should be using the ocean temperature as the basis for measuring what's happening on planet Earth rather than the global mean temperature, but that's another whole debate. Now, this summer, Canada lost its last big ice sheet, and a Greenland ice shelf called 79N just shattered in September. It looks to me like one of the biggest early impacts of climate change is showing up at the ice sheets and the glacier fronts of Greenland and Antarctica. Would you agree with that?
That's certainly one of the manifestations. So that's one way, that's, you know, aside from the ocean warming up and the ocean heat content increasing, which also leads to expansion of the ocean and then rising sea level. So rising sea level is certainly something to be considered. The other aspect where the heat accumulates is by melting ice. And so there's very good evidence of that with Greenland melting at record rates, and also parts of Antarctica, mainly around the fringe and especially around the Antarctic Peninsula area, with a number of big icebergs cracking off and breaking off of the mainland there and melting. And so some of that's being put in place by the ocean being warmer and undermining some of the ice shelves that are around Antarctica and also around Greenland. So, yeah, that's another manifestation of it. And, you know, Arctic sea ice continues to go down. It's possible that in this September we might break another record. It's very close to the all-time record low. And so Arctic sea ice is down by over 40%, 45%, compared with the values when we could really start measuring them in 1979, which is when the satellite measurements got underway.
Beyond how much the ocean is warming, we also need to know how fast it is warming. You published on that question in 2019. What did you find?
Yes, the oceans are continuing to warm. The rate is, as I mentioned before, enough that every year pretty much is breaking records, with the slight exception of small blips from El Nino. So this is mainly the case since about maybe 2005. Actually, that's when the really good measurements begin. But we can carry the record back fairly reliably to about 1958, which was the International Geophysical Year. And that's when a lot of new measurements began, including measurements in Antarctica for the first time. The fact that we're seeing these record temperatures in the oceans sets the stage for all of the regional, what we call anomalies, the departures from normal that occur So we are seeing increasingly marine heat waves in different parts of the world. And these have greatly upset many aspects of the marine biosphere, all of the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, the fish, the marine animals, the gulls and birds. And some of these marine heat waves have been quite deadly. There's been a couple in the Pacific. There's been a couple down here near New Zealand, between Australia and New Zealand, that have had tremendous effects. And they haven't received as much attention in the media, and the general public may not be as aware of these as perhaps they should be. And it's partly because, you know, we live on land rather than on the oceans. And you know, one of the warm spots this year, it has been the tropical Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico. And so back in April, it was predicted that there would be a very active hurricane season this year. And that's what allows us to make that prediction. It's because not just the sea surface temperatures, but the upper ocean heat content is at record high levels.
So the last World Synthesis report we had from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was the AR5 in 2013. Given the pace of climate change, I think that IPCC process takes far too long, but how did that 2013 best estimate of ocean warming hold up to what we know now in 2020?
Yes, well, there has been a special report from IPCC since then that has updated those values a bit. But even there, the IPCC tends to be very conservative, and the numbers have been revised, and they've been revised upwards somewhat since then. We published a major paper on this, and in fact, you mentioned before, a Chinese scientist, and I'm a collaborator with that Chinese scientist. His name is Li Jing Chang from Beijing, and I've visited with him, and he's visited with me at NCAR. And so we're collaborating on a lot of this work and updating all of the ocean heat content now. And so we found better ways of analyzing what's going on. And in fact, we just have a new result that's been published within the last week, as it turns out, where we have updated all of the salinity information around the world. And we've got a global reconstruction of the top 2,000 meters of salinity back to 1960. And so that actually shows some very interesting patterns which relate to the overall hydrological cycle, rainfall, and evaporation around the world.
The deep abyss of the ocean is colder and slower to change than surface waters. Are we sure that global warming has penetrated those deep places, and will that factor continue as a sort of place we can hide the excess energy we're trapping with the greenhouse atmosphere?
Well, certainly the ocean is a place where heat gets taken up and sequestered. And so in that sense, that heat is not manifested as the surface climate. So the oceans play an important role in that regard. In the early 2000s, a new observing system was put in place in the oceans. It's called ARGO, A-R-G-O, and it consists of a whole lot of what are called profiling floats. These are devices. They're about a meter tall, like a tube, and they contain a whole bunch of instruments. They have a chamber inside which can be pumped to be either full of seawater, in which case these floats sink, and they can also be pumped, vacated, and in that case the floats rise and they pop up to the surface, and when they're at the surface, they radio all of their information that they measure as they're going up and down to satellites and back down to base stations. And so as they go up and down, they take measurements of temperature and salinity. And so we've got really good measurements of temperature and salinity in the top 2,000 meters of the ocean since about 2005 globally. There's some measurements before then, but not a lot. The older measurements were from expendable bathymographs that were put overboard from ships and only occur along ship tracks. But by having the information from this ARGO array, we've been able to understand better how the ocean holds together, what the covariability is in space and time, and that is what has allowed us to make these analyses back in time, as long as there's sufficient data to do that. And as I mentioned before, we can do that now back to about 1958.
So many reports and reporters are satisfied to know what the climate will be or might be at the end of this century, but ocean scientists know global warming does not stop for a nice rest in the year 2100. And for me, that human short-sightedness is part of a kind of horror. Won't the ocean just keep releasing heat for centuries, no matter what humans manage to do?
Well, the source of the heat, of course, is the buildup of carbon dioxide. So it depends what we do with the composition of the atmosphere. But even if we stop increasing the amount of emissions into the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide concentrations still continue to go up because carbon dioxide has a very long lifetime. And a lot of that heat ends up, 93% of it ends up in the ocean. And so the ocean continues to warm, and it adjusts on quite a long time scale. The upper ocean adjusts on a maybe 10 to 20 year time frame, but the deep ocean responds very, very slowly. Below 2,000 meters, we have very few really good measurements. They are good measurements. They're good to a hundredth of a degree. But fortunately, we don't need that many because the ocean down there is not dynamic. There's no waves like there is near the surface and turbulence. And so we do have some handle on what the deep ocean is doing. And even if, the global warming aspects from the increase in greenhouse gases cease, then the oceans will continue to gradually warm as the heat penetrates further and further down into the ocean. So global warming sort of continues and has a memory for a couple of centuries at least as to, what we've done. And so, as you say, 2100 is a nice round number, and it's used quite often. But the prospects are that global climate change will continue well beyond 2100.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Dr. Kevin Trenberth on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Kevin, how can we interest the public in ocean warming? I don't think we can leave this as something for specialists and scientists.
So, one manifestation of it, as I mentioned before, is the marine heat waves and especially the changes in hurricanes. So hurricanes or typhoons in the Pacific or cyclones in the Indian Ocean, they've all had quite unusual aspects to them in the last 3 years in particular. In the Indian Ocean, there have been tropical cyclones, as they call them, in places where they haven't been before, and some of the impacts have been huge around the east coast of Africa and in India and Pakistan. Although I must say, in India and Pakistan, they have developed evacuation plans that put the U.S. to shame, I might say. Whereas in the past, there could have been 1,000 or more deaths. There have only been a few score deaths in a couple of recent events that otherwise would have been devastating. But still, it undermines all of the livelihood in those areas. And so people in coastal regions are very much aware of this. As I mentioned before, one of the other manifestations we're seeing now, and this relates especially to climates that are called a Mediterranean climate, where there's a long, dry summer. So that applies in Australia and also on the West Coast and in Oregon and California. There's all of these wildfires or bushfires, as they call them in Australia. And it applies also in southern Europe and Portugal and Spain and France, where they've also had quite a number of fires. So those are manifestations that are very visible, and I hope the public is paying attention. They certainly wouldn't have occurred anything like this way without the human influence on climate change.
Here in the Northern Hemisphere, we had what I think will be labeled the hottest summer ever recorded. Does that affect the Southern Hemisphere? Will it affect possibly the summer wildfire season coming up in Australia?
Not so directly. Currently, we've just gone into a rather weak La Nina, and El Nino, the El Nino phenomenon and its opposite, the La Nina, is the biggest influence around the world as to the weather patterns and which areas are going to be drought-stricken, which areas are prone to heavy rains and flooding. And so there is some connectivity globally in that regard. Certainly the hemispheres are connected, but the main connection is directly through the atmosphere and the changing composition of the atmosphere. So anything that northern hemisphere puts into the atmosphere does, on about a year time frame, affect the southern hemisphere anyway.
You've been working on a new paper that's just coming out, and I've heard you may be working on a book. Can you talk to us about your current work?
The book that I'm working on is called The Changing Flow of Energy Through the Climate System. And so it actually tries to deal with physically how all of these things occur. So how does the extra heat that we get from the increasing greenhouse effect get manifested in terms of changes in temperature and changes in the ice around the world, the Greenland and Antarctica and glaciers and sea ice? How does it affect the land, including all of these wildfires and so forth? The book is also very much about the changes in the water cycle, and that includes, of course, the droughts and the heavy rains and the floods and the risks to that. That's one of the other manifestations. And so places like Michigan this spring were inundated with waters all over the place, and that's occurred increasingly frequently in the spring over the United States. So there's many manifestations of climate change and actually how they come about and why the extremes are affected is a key part of what we're dealing with in the book. The paper, which we have just published, deals with changes in salinity around the world, and the Atlantic Ocean is a lot more saline than the Pacific Ocean, and the ocean circulation is rather different in the Atlantic than it is in the Pacific, partly as a consequence of that. And it relates to the transport of moisture in the tropics from the Atlantic into the Pacific to enable that to happen. And what we've been able to show is that the salinity is changing in such a way that the places which were already relatively salty are getting saltier, and the places that were already fresher are, in fact, getting fresher in the ocean. And so the extremes are increasing within the ocean, and this has consequences for marine life. And one of the reasons for that is because of precipitation. And so one of the sayings we have is that the wet areas get wetter and the dry areas get drier, because there's a lot of spatial character to where it rains. And because there's more moisture in the atmosphere from evaporation, that it gets transported into places where it's raining, then that's what gets concentrated and produces the fresher areas, or in the places where it's getting saltier, the increased evaporation tends to dominate. And so we've been able to document that this is happening. And in this sense, we're treating the ocean as sort of like a great big huge rain gauge, and it provides new evidence as to what's happening to the water cycle over the oceans.
Will that change the salinity changes? Will that change the power of some of the ocean currents?
That's a good question, because salinity is a key part of the density of the ocean, and more saline water is heavier. And so, indeed, it can affect the overall circulation. There is a circulation called the thermohaline circulation. Thermo refers to temperature. Haline refers to the salt. And the combination of those two things is what produces the density of the ocean water. And so in high latitudes in the Arctic, the water is cold and salty and tends to sink. The Gulf Stream is one of the things which links to that. And then deeper in the ocean, there is a return current which goes in the other direction all the way into the southern hemisphere, that helps to move the salinity around, the salt around, and also moves heat around. And so these currents are apt to be changed somewhat as these changes in salinity occur, and also changes in heat, yes.
So much great climate science has poured out of American institutions and government-backed institutions like NCAR. American satellites have put out real incredible data on the world. Is American climate science under threat?
In some ways, yes. The Trump administration has been a denier of climate change and has not helped the whole discourse and the funding of climate science. It's one of the reasons I left the United States and moved to New Zealand, in fact. And so the whole leadership of the United States in this whole area of science is under threat. And there was a recent appointment of a denier of climate change to NOAA. Fortunately, it'll be a short-term appointment, I hope, only through the end of the Trump term. But that's one of the indications, you know, and the fact that the Trump administration wants to take the United States out of the Paris Agreement on climate change is another aspect of that. And so, yes, it has not been good.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, the whole climate change story is an important one. It greatly affects the next generation and the generation beyond. Your kids, your grandkids, if you have any, are very much subject to the kind of planet you leave them, and we ought to be paying a lot more attention to these issues and doing a lot more. There's a lot that can be done, but it's going to be a very, very difficult problem. And in fact, it will dwarf the problems that we see with the COVID-19 pandemic, because there is no vaccine against climate change.
From New Zealand, we have been speaking with longtime distinguished scholar at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, Dr. Kevin Trenberth. You can find links to follow up on the news and science we've talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Kevin, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for sharing with our radio community.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In this interview, we hope to learn two fundamental climate lessons from the long history of Earth. Research finds destabilization of a climate can lead to strange states of weather beyond our imagination and lasting a million years or more. And second, we find yet another case, a new discovery, when global warming led to a mass extinction event, or at least was related to it. Apparently, we're not in the sixth mass extinction so often cited, but the seventh. Life on Earth is less stable than humans realize. Mike Benton is a professor of vertebrate paleontology at the UK's University of Bristol. He is a co-author of a new study published in Science Advances, announcing the discovery of a mass extinction event not previously known, and it's not often we can say that. Mike Benton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Please start by outlining what your team found, and then we'll build from there.
We're looking at a mass extinction event that hasn't really been fully recognized. And to put you in context, we're all familiar with the mass extinction that happened 66 million years ago when the dinosaurs died out. But this is an event that happened at the beginning of the dinosaurs. So in a way, their history is bookended by two big crises. The final one that everybody is familiar with was when an asteroid hit the Earth, and there were all kinds of terrible consequences in terms of blacking out the sun with the dust that came out of the impact site, which led to global cooling, freezing, lack of light, killing of plants, all of that kind of thing. But the event we're looking at, which is called technically the Carnian Pluvial Episode, the Carnian is the interval of time. We're talking about a time something like 233 million years ago. And the pluvial refers to rainfall, which we can talk about a little, an episode, because it lasted for a million years. It wasn't like the end of the Cretaceous, the 66 million year ago event, which was kind of instantaneous. It was like, you know, one day the whole thing happens. So what we found is that an event that people had thought was restricted to Europe, and we knew for a long time there was perturbation in marine life and coral reefs and the rest of it at this time in the Carnian, turns out to be global, thanks to additional work that people are doing in countries like China and Argentina, where there hadn't been a great deal of work up to now. And so the final part of the story that made it all work, if you like, that gave us the insight, was that we've identified the smoking gun. So my co-author, Jacopo Dal Corso, who is from Italy, but he was studying in the UK at the time, he's identified the smoking gun, and it's the Wrangellia basalts of Canada. So that's Wrangellia with a W. And they are currently to be seen on the west coast of Canada, north of Vancouver. And what was going on was 233 million years ago, these basalts were being pumped out of the earth through a fissure. These are not explosive volcanoes, but fissure crack volcanoes. But the volume of lava, and more importantly, the volume of gas that was being produced at that time was enough to create a global effect. Put simply, and we can maybe go into the detail later, put simply, there were a number of pulses of warming by 6 or 7 degrees centigrade, coupled with acid phases, phases of acidification, acid rain on land, acidification of the ocean. And so the warming and acidification were the killers.
But that's just what we have right now, is warming and acidification of the oceans.
This is why it's potentially quite important. People have talked about the end of the dinosaurs and the fact that the Earth can be hit by asteroids unexpectedly. Well, that may happen again, but what can you do to prepare? I think this is where the relevance comes in, because whereas when I started studying this event many years ago, 40 years ago, the quality of data that we could read from the rock and fossil records was kind of hidden. It was kind of difficult to put your finger on because the precision of measurements were not that great. But technically, a lot of that is now a lot better than it was.
And until now, experts warned we are entering the sixth mass extinction. I've done programs about it, and I remember reading the 1995 book, The Sixth Extinction, by biologist Richard Leakey and science journalist Roger Lewin. Now we have to say humans are driving the seventh extinction. Isn't that a bit of a shock?
It is a shock, and some would disagree with it, but it's a fair point, because as far as we can tell, our estimates of the scale of the event, it's something like 30% of genera, which is maybe 50% of species killed off. That's on a par with many of the other mass extinctions. But the jury is still out on whether we number it that way, because the big five, as they are sometimes called, they are agreed. Everybody accepts them. They're huge. There are a number of other extinction events have happened in the history of the Earth, and this is one of them, which might or might not rank as mass extinctions on that scale. So that's still an issue to be fixed. But I think the fact that people, right from that time, the book you mentioned, The Sixth Mass Extinction, is the correct point of view, because we don't draw a line between the present day and the deep time history of the Earth. And we used to, because, of course, that deep time history of the Earth was kind of hidden from us. We could collect the fossils, we could look at the rocks, but we were quite woolly, quite unsure about the dating. And if we tried to do some chemical analyses to try to understand aspects of the ancient climate, often those measurements were not that great. But I think now the methods are pretty good. And just as a single example, how do we know that there were pulses of warming? And how do we know that it was global? So we know the volcanic eruptions were happening off Canada. We know that it was global because we can detect the signature of the warming episodes in places as far apart as England and Italy, China, Argentina. How do we detect it at a distance? We don't. It's not because we're finding ash or any consequences of their, anything solid coming out of the volcano. It's because the temperature can be read from the rocks by using the oxygen isotopes. So oxygen is normally in the form of oxygen-16, but there are other heavier isotopes, oxygen-18, for example, that can also be detected chemically in the rocks. And these signatures tend to be fixed, and they represent what were the conditions when the rocks were deposited. So these are, for example, limestones we look at. And in certain sections in England and other places, we can detect as many as 5 pulses of warming, because you can see that switch in the isotope ratio, which indicates the temperature change. It's being calibrated as a so-called paleothermometer. How do we know it's accurate? Because people have tested it in real-life situations where they measure the values using the mass spectrometer and of modern-day examples, and then they can compare them. And this can be repeated many times. So we find the same signals. We can estimate temperature rises of maybe 5, 6, 7 degrees centigrade.
So we're struggling, hoping to keep the climate under 2 degrees of warming C over pre-industrial now. But you've just said that it warmed at least twice that. How long did it take for that to develop? Do we know?
I think it, as far as we can tell, it's pretty instant, because when the in the sense that when the volcano erupts, not only is the lava poured out, some will remember Mount St. Helens, the effect locally was instant and devastating. The amount of gas that was produced by Mount St. Helens was enough to be detected over most of North America. It did cause acid rain. It did cause local warming on a small scale. But these eruptions were much larger, and there's nothing to say, of course, that such huge eruptions can't happen again, because they had happened many times in the past. And in fact, in terms of climate change, it doesn't matter whether the carbon dioxide, the methane, the water vapor, the greenhouse gases, in other words, come from a natural process like a volcanic eruption, or whether they come from human production, from factories and cars. Doesn't matter. It has the same effect on the temperature. And the interesting point here is that we're looking at a rise of 1 degree, as you say, 2 degrees. This is the kind of legal, the attempted effort globally to limit it. And many people say 2 degrees is nothing. You know, that's just like between getting up and an hour later. You know, the temperature rises and falls. But you know full well, of course, at the global scale, this is a different matter. 5 or 6 degrees. So we're already seeing the difference with 1 degree at the moment, of course, in massively changed weather patterns, the increase in hurricanes, and we're detecting this in Europe as well. We're used to quite a gentle climate in England. We're not getting a gentle climate anymore. Some colleagues in the south of England say, well, it'll be quite nice if we get warmer temperatures. We can grow our own vines and we can make wine. But if you're a citizen of Africa living somewhere around the Sahara Desert, you're not happy, because the size of the desert is increasing all the time and you're losing your farmland to desert because 1 or 2 degrees can have that effect. So, of course, then historically we can look back at these ancient events where we know the temperature change of maybe 5 or 6 degrees and the acid rain associated, and we can see the effect. The effect was 50% extinction of species. 50%. So 5 or 6 degrees doesn't sound much, but my goodness, the impact is substantial.
And in the introduction, I spoke of strange states of weather, and one of the weirdest has to be this Carnian pluvial episode. What was it like then, Mike Benton?
Initially, it would sound rather favorable, because pluvial means extra rainfall. And this is linked to the rise in temperature, particularly in the tropical belt. And the rise in temperature caused intake of water from surrounding oceans. It's probably something to do with the layout of the continents at that time, because we have to imagine a world where you reverse continental drift and all the continents join together again. The Atlantic Ocean closes, Europe nuzzles up against Nova Scotia and New York, and Africa nuzzles up against South America. And so there was a single continental landmass running more or less from the northern to the southern hemisphere. And so climates were quite arid because the equatorial belt was broken by that huge landmass, whereas, of course, at the moment it's not, because we've got the Atlantic and the Pacific lying across. And so the rising temperatures seem to have modified and given you that humid temperature, so that was fine. But when the volcanic eruption stopped, temperatures remained high, rainfall ceased, and there's a massive arid or dry phase came along, and that seems to be when the extinctions happened in particular.
I was introduced to this idea in 2018. A journalist named Peter Brennan wrote an article in Atlantic magazine titled "A Climate Catastrophe Paved the Way for the Dinosaurs' Reign." His guide to that, incidentally, was one of your co-authors, Massimo Bernardi. What's new in your paper that's just been published in the journal Science Advances?
What's new is that we're taking it beyond the origin of dinosaurs. So just in a nutshell, what we said in that 2018 paper was that thanks to improved quality of rock dating, we were able to use the North Italian limestone successions that Massimo Bernardi is familiar with, which document the shallow marine rock succession. And in fact, that part of Italy, the beautiful Dolomites Mountains, is the sort of world classic site because the rocks of that age are so abundant and well documented and well dated. And thanks to radioisotopic dating and other means of correlation, we were able in that paper to correlate from those marine sections in Italy to some land sections in Argentina. And the importance of those beds in Argentina, the so-called Isla Galasto formation, is that they contain the first evidence of abundant dinosaurs on Earth. So a lot of people have spent a lot of time trying to date the Isla Galasto beds as accurately as they can, because this marks the beginning of the rule of the dinosaurs. And we were able to link them across to the European sections and tie them into the global timescale, and corroborate that by deposits with trackways in Italy. So Bernardi was able to document that up to this level, 233, 232 million years ago, no signs of dinosaur tracks. Above that level, abundant dinosaur tracks. So we were just making that point. And then since then, I think the additional evidence on the dating of the rocks, the fact that we can now link it across to China, thanks to a lot of new work there, and some of the additional isotopic work on the paleotemperatures. Those are the new components.
So I understand from your paper that the great coral reefs that we treasure so much, the form that we know today began in that period, 233 million years ago, and there were extinctions and great changes in land animals. But I don't really understand yet why dinosaurs gained dominance due to this period of climate change.
Yes, so I'll say a word about the coral reefs first and then link that through to the dinosaurs. So the effects were profound. And up to that point, the buildup of limestone in the oceans happened in a particular way. And then that massively changed after the event. And we have to think of mass extinctions as obviously being bad news for the species that are killed, but it can be an opportunity for the new species. And so the point was that soon after the Carnian pluvial event, new kinds of plankton emerged and became abundant in the oceans, so-called dinoflagellates, which make a calcium carbonate skeleton. And from that point, and at the same time, the modern types of corals became established and started building coral reefs in shallower water. And so those two things meant there was a big change in the circulation of carbonate, and particularly the carbon, because up to that point, carbon used to accumulate only on the continental shelf. After that point, a lot of it fell into the deep ocean from these plankton with their calcium carbonate shells. And so before the event, limestones developed in great thicknesses on the shelf. After the event, they developed on the shelf and in the deeper water. And that gave a greater stability to the world's carbon cycle, purely by chance. So that was a very good effect, if you like, because as long as limestone was only accumulating in shallow waters, If there was a sudden change in sea level, and these things happen, of course, many times, then the limestones could be exposed if sea levels fell, or they could sink deep beneath the waves if sea levels rise. So there's a lot less stability in the carbonate factory, as it's called, and also in terms of the overall global carbon cycle, which is very important, the way carbon goes through the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide, which is consumed by plants, which builds the structure of the plants. It locks up the carbon into the plants, but also plankton in the oceans absorb carbon dioxide and take the carbon out and build their skeletons. Then that carbon falls to the seabed, builds up limestones, and they get eventually dissolved and broken down, and the carbon returns into the cycle. But what about the dinosaurs? So it seems that before this event, the world contained a variety of rather primitive plant types and plant-eating reptiles, which had kind of survived for quite a long time. They'd been through previous mass extinctions, and they were important components of ecosystems on land. And with the wetting followed by sharp drying of the Carnian Pluvial event, at the end of the event, remember, it went from humid to exceptionally dry, and we can tell this in detail from the rock successions, even though we don't fully understand why in terms of climate evolution. And that meant that at that point of switch from humid to dry, many of these seed ferns and other primitive kinds of plants died out, and with them went their dominant herbivores. And of course, in a terrestrial ecosystem, it's the plants and the plant eaters that are the base of the food chain. And although it was the loss of only a limited number of species, that massively affected the structure of ecosystems on land. And the dinosaurs, which had actually originated much earlier and had never really gained any toehold, they remained very small. They were very unimportant, fewer than 1% of the community. They survived. They were in some way able to cope with the drier conditions. They were able to eat the dry land plants like conifers and other groups that were able to survive. They were then able to opportunistically, it seems, occupy the kind of destroyed ecosystems and rebuild them. And within 5 million years after this crisis, dinosaurs essentially ruled the earth. They'd got abundant, they'd got diverse, and they'd got big.
Looking forward, Peter Brannon wrote in The Atlantic, the global water cycle could intensify by 24% by 2100, end quote. So how does that relate to the increase of humidity in the Carnian Pluvial?
I think this will be the same kind of process, and the modeling of what was happening in the Carnian is much harder because, of course, although we can modify our modern climate models, of course, there's a whole community of researchers working using a variety of different climate models. They can be applied to times in the geological past. They behave very differently because the organization of continents is very different. So I think we all know that when you run climate models today, the distribution of ocean and land will affect where the water evaporates and where the rain falls. And because of the different layout of the Earth at that time, with a substantial single landmass straddling the equator and without any great oceans at the equator, then the way the model works is substantially different. But that aspect of generation of substantial rainfall around the equator does seem to be shared between the past and the present. However, I'm not so sure that we can read larger lessons from that particular point.
The new paper in Science Advances is part of your continuing work in China, as you mentioned, and with Chinese academics. Why go to China to find records of the distant past?
I think China has the advantage that during this time, a lot of rock was being deposited. So there's a lot of marine and terrestrial successions. But for researchers, I think researchers around the world are diving into China as best they can, collaborating with Chinese colleagues, partly because it's a largely virgin territory for geologists, because modern type geology and paleontology only got started there maybe in the 1990s. And so there are many opportunities. Apart from this, many people will be familiar with the sites of exceptional fossil preservation, and they have wonderful locations where you can find fossils of the earliest animals, Chengjiang, and you can find in other deposits fossils of early birds and dinosaurs with feathers and all kinds of wonderful things like that. So not that necessarily China has a unique key in terms of opening the secrets of the history of the Earth and the history of life. It's like turning the clock back 200 years to what it was like in Europe when the first geologists and paleontologists started digging around and discovering amazing things. We've kind of exhausted a lot of what there may be to find in Europe and North America, so we love going into new places.
So for at least 30 years, Mike Benton, you've been working from fine details of distant creatures, like the feathers you talked about, to the big picture. How do those small parts build to a view of how life branches out during these periods of extreme changes in geology and climate? And that's something we may need to know right now.
Yes, it's a great question, because at one level, I think everybody is familiar with the kids' excitement about dinosaurs. You can read endless dinosaur books, you can see them in museums, you can even go and collect fossils and all of that. But how can you turn that into big scientific knowledge? I think I'll just give one example, which is to do with the measurement of temperature. I think it's because of two things. We have instruments and theory in chemistry, which it can be applied to the rocks. And for example, I think the argument would be people often have a simple view of what is science and what is not science. People think of their chemistry class, and you're given a task to do. You mix a certain amount of chemical A with a certain amount of chemical B, and you get a predictable reaction, because the theory tells you this is what will happen, this is what happens, and you can repeat it any number of times. Now, when it gets to the earth sciences, which is the term we use globally for understanding of climate and rocks and fossils, when it gets to the earth sciences, of course, the earth has got a single history. And I don't think it would be either ethical or possible to run an experiment and say, okay, guys, let's try and solve this global warming question. We need to run an experiment where we tune up the temperature of the Earth by 10 degrees C and let's see what happens. Well, of course, for all sorts of reasons, you can't do that. But I think a more subtle view of science is that you can have repeated events. So here we have, for example, as you noted right at the start, a combination of natural processes that are affecting the climate and the oxygen and carbon cycles, which have actually been repeated. So this kind of scenario that I mentioned, volcanic eruption leading to warming, perhaps humidity in many cases also leading to acidification, that has actually happened maybe half a dozen times in the history of the Earth. And so actually we have natural experiments there, so we'd better use them. You know, we can't do the lab experiment that I described. That would be crazy. But we actually have these examples, and thank goodness it's moved from a sort of just-so story, a kind of inspired guesswork, which professors in a previous generation would have had to apply, to a much more instrumental, numerical fundamentals of science, fundamentals of chemistry, fundamentals of statistics and so on, set of processes. And indeed, a lot of this, these methods, we can teach to our undergraduates. And so a lot of it is much more feasible and not as expensive as it might have been.
We all want to know what is coming. And you are co-author of another paper that offers some natural rules. That paper, published in July 2020, is Predicting Biotic Responses to Future Climate Warming with Classic Ecogeographic Rules. What are ecogeographic rules and how can they help us?
This was an inspiration of my co-author there, Tian Li, who is a young researcher at the Wuhan University of Geology. And he had noted these rules, which were mainly compiled by Victorian age, 19th century researchers. This was the great age of sailing around the world. Charles Darwin did it, and he got a lot of inspiration. Many others did it. The most familiar one of these rules, which many ecologists are familiar with, is called Bergman's rule, named after a person called Bergman. And he noticed, for mammals at least, that the cooler the climate, the bigger the mammal. And there's a sort of logic there, because if you're warm-blooded, you generate your own internal heat, and you have insulation in the case of cold conditions. But if you are bigger, like the polar bear in northern climates, it's easier to retain that heat. So what we were thinking was, if we, and there are about a dozen other rules of that kind, which have got something to say about size or color, the color of the fur, the length of limbs, whether you've got long legs or short legs, all kinds of other things, relate to observations around climate and latitude in the present day. So we thought, what if we could just suggest this? So Bergman's rule works in the present day. It's a commonly understood point about biogeography. If global temperatures get warmer, would you predict that mammals would get smaller? We leave it as a question, but you could. And then other rules would suggest that perhaps with increasing temperature and changing humidity, certain groups might get darker in color, others would get paler in color. We could regard it just as a sort of fun game. Who cares, you might think. But it's an attempt to use a great deal of knowledge. And the Bergman's rule is not like the law of gravity. This is not a fundamental, mathematically provable point. It's just a common, it's an observation, it's true, because it's what we see. And we can understand it in terms of ecology and physiology, because if you're warm-blooded, it's more efficient to be larger, because the density and the rate of heat loss is less in colder climates. So those are the kinds of predictions which I think people thought it was a fun idea, and maybe people can have a look and see whether it works.
Do you think we are dangerously destabilizing a system that is meaner than we thought?
Yes, I think I'm not. This is not an original observation. I think many people have commented. And yes, systems on the Earth have measures of homeostasis. They can recover. So, for example, Mount St. Helens went off. It had devastating local effects. It pumped carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But in time, the forests around absorbed that carbon dioxide. The forest regrew. And in a sense, there's no trace of it, really. You know, you can see it if you walk around. But that wound has been healed. But I suppose the worry, as many people have pointed out, this is not an original point of mine, is that human activity is unrelenting. Whereas Mount St. Helens stopped, it didn't just keep erupting and erupting. It stopped, and that gave nature a chance to heal the wound. The rate at which we're destroying rainforests in Brazil and pumping and throwing plastic into the oceans seems to be increasing. And I guess if we stop, then the wounds can be healed. But there's not a great deal of evidence that we're actually going to stop those things.
From the University of Bristol, we've been speaking with Professor Mike Benton. He is co-author of the new study, Extinction and Dawn of the Modern World in the Carnian, Late Triassic. Find links to the science and news we have talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Mike, thank you for sharing your time with us.
It's a pleasure.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned next week for more breaking science about our world as hard times become a challenging future.